He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin. This is Car Keys.
Ah, yes it is. And I am reading a headline as we start today's show, which says, or almost shouts at you, Bronco fans will get V8 / at a high price. I just read the article quickly, and it's going to be a $200,000 plus or minus range vehicle, initially limited to not many annual production numbers. And it's all because Bronco fans have been clamoring for a V8 ever since Bronco is being revived. I think that is, you know, foolhardy, at least at a $200,000 vehicle price range. But more to the point, aftermarket people can put those engines in and do it better, as well as Ford can off a production line. And I just think it's foolish to overdo this Bronco renewal situation by doing it, putting a V8 in, unless they want to charge like $85,000 for that vehicle, as opposed to the projected in the article $200,000 range. Jay, you want to jump in?
Oh, Robin, sure. Let me just say this. I think the Bronco and that sort of vehicle is ridiculous to start with. I think this, I know there's a huge market for that. I just think those vehicles and the Jeep Wrangler are just being ridiculed by what Rivian can do with modern technology and four electric motors going, one on each wheel, and climbing rocks like none of these vehicles can do, whether with a V8 or not. So, I think it's all a lot of marketing and a lot of hype. And yeah, some people will buy them, and V8s sound great, but you're right, they're going to be $80,000 or so, and if
they need to be only that, as opposed to the projected range in the article.
So let's not spend too much time.
No, I don't want to. I want to agree with a lot of your comments. I want to go to add to the Rivian situation, which is going to be a spectacularly wonderful vehicle, I believe. I watched a video on the Hummer, electric Hummer, over the weekend, and it was fascinating to watch the crab claw maneuverability feature that it has, as well as how well it was doing crawling over rocks and ground like the Rivian can do with these electric motors, which is telling us that that's going to be a spectacularly successful vehicle if you want to spend well over $100,000 probably for the electric Hummer. It starts at 100 plus, I think, for the base model. But you're right, Jay. The electric vehicles in for off-roading are going to be very interesting. I think I don't know whether the Rivian. I don't know the Rivian might, but I don't think the Hummer, the big Hummer, and the Rivian maybe is going to be able to do something like the Rubicon Trail. Because I think there's too many narrow areas on the Rubicon Trail, although I have never been to it, so I can't speak from an experience, which I thought maybe one time in my life I would like to have tried. But as far as the uniqueness of these two vehicles coming onto our streets pretty darn soon, they're going to get a certain amount of play that the Jeep Wranglers and Ford Broncos are going to just be left behind on, although they are not apples to apples by any means.
So let's just remember that SUVs are mostly driven on roads, right?
I mean, yes, they are, which makes
in the country, but on asphalt covered roads. And yep. To that effect, by the way, Rivian, I just read about that. I didn't know about this. Rivian is coming out, I think, in 2023. With their first crossover. So they're already getting away from, you know, a pure truck. You know, they're starting with a pickup truck, then they're going to the SUV a version of that truck, which is probably going to be, you know, something like a Chevy Tahoe or a converted pickup truck, although a lot more civilized, I think. And they're just going to go more towards road vehicles, and that's where the numbers are. And that's what people do with their vehicles. So let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah, I do not know where there are going to be places for people who buy the new Hummers and the Rivian pickups to do off-roading are going to find those places that are going to be utilized in general recreational manner by any of these owners. You, for example, Ford's got a Bronco test track or test place up in New Hampshire where a friend of mine who received his Bronco Badlands edition a couple of months ago just spent a day with 8 to 12 other owners up in the woods of New Hampshire. I can't remember what the name of the town was, but they spent several hours driving Ford-owned vehicles there. They were not. They drove up in their own vehicles, but they couldn't. They didn't. Couldn't use them on the test roads that Ford allowed them to drive around on in their own test vehicles, and they had a blast. Is this guy who owns this Bronco going to find any other place to go doing what I used to do when I first had my Bronco? And when there were four-wheel drive clubs in the East, I know there are plenty of them out West still, but they have places in State Forest for us. What?
Didn't you flip a Bronco on a curb?
Yeah, on a state highway in New Milford, Connecticut. I rolled it 360 degrees, landed right side up going the other way. And
that's funny.
I hit a curb trying to avoid running into the back end of a car, which pulled out in the middle of a very dark, rainy night onto the highway going the same direction I was going, but did not give me any time to plan on how little distance I was going to have behind that vehicle. And to avoid it, I steered to the right, and the right front tire hit these curbs they put to control the drainage. And the suspensions of these vehicles are taut, which means very firm, and it bounced
they
me
were
into
primitive.
A roll. And that was that. But I don't think many people are going to be doing anything more with their Broncos than they do with their, not their Cadillacs, but their Volkswagens and the like for most of their ownership situation. So how relevant all these vehicles are going into the electric world or into the future, I don't know, Jay.
So I got the chance this week to drive two very fine upscale
vehicles.
Vehicles, SUVs, and still gasoline-powered with gasoline-powered engines. And one was a Porsche Macan, brand new, with the new base four-cylinder engine, turbo engine, a turbo four, like in a lot of cars, 260 horsepower, perfectly adequate performance, a perfect blend of sportiness and comfort in the suspension. Porsche 7-speed PDK automated manual transmission is just fantastic. And, it's not an inexpensive car, obviously. I think the base price is just under $60,000. But it really is a nice alternative to a Q5 or, an X5. And it's probably between the size of an X5 and an X3, but it's a great car, and obviously it's high end, upscale, stands out in the crowd, very well built, and very 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 pleasant to drive. Not very big inside, but it's a choice. And the other SUV was a full size BMW X7 M. And it is, that is a 520 horsepower twin turbo V8, and the thing just goes. And it's about as good as any SUV gets, and it does everything well. But it's also a $100,000 plus vehicle. It was great driving those cars, also knowing, and their owners probably know that they're on their last. They just purchased the last cars that will be powered by conventional gasoline engines, and we're back circling back to electric.
We've been so far discussing in this particular show $100,000 plus vehicles that are coming on stream for the American and the world people, drivers to buy. And so let's go to the other end of the mini cars, which are losing relevance in terms of some articles and some minds, as to being really something that's going to remain in production for years to come for the public, except maybe in electric vehicle form. And that's the Mini Cooper. And as you said to me in our back and forth before the show, the Fiat Cinquecentos, I don't consider the Minis and the Cinquecentos, the Fiat 500s, to be apples to apples either, because they're just two different, except for maybe the Abarth version of the Fiat 500. There's nothing in their lineup that is equivalent to the current Mini lineup of vehicles, which has two or three sizes. And the Fiat does have a couple of sizes still remaining in the U.S., but they're disappearing because there's no dealer structure and there's no public interest in buying that, as opposed to a Mini, if anybody's going to consider that size vehicle. But
it was a fad, in my opinion.
Yeah, and the problem with these small cars is they lose production numbers. They become already less, even more less profitable for the manufacturers than they are in the beginning, because, you know, if they don't sell in enough of a numerical numbers to make the assembly lines worth running 24/7, or, you know, 5 days a week for yearly, year after year, there's no reason for the manufacturer to keep producing the parts and components to make them, because they're losing money in every car that they probably produce off the assembly line. So that's that on that topic. You have some other topics you wanted to bring up, Jay.
Yeah, it got cold this week.
No kidding.
One of the cars, so I was driving this, you know, very high-end BMW X7, and the tire pressure monitor was on. And at the end of the day, I brought it, you know, at the end of the day, because I knew there was air in the tires, I brought it to a local a shop, and I said, hey, could you, you know, put a little air in my tires? And it takes more than just putting air in the tires. Then you have to go in the software, you know, and go into the tire pressure monitor system and do a reset. And you just have to know, and back to the whole point of having to know how the functions work in any particular, you know, new car.
Totally ridiculous.
Yes, well, and we've got over that. But anyway...
Yeah, but the listeners ought to know that if they're going to buy a BMW.
This car shop owner just laughed because I must have been the 20th guy, and this was earlier this week. I can't remember if it was Tuesday, Wednesday. It was the first or second cold day, and all of a sudden, everybody's tire pressure monitors
lights
went on, blinking in their cars, and they all headed half panicky to the car shop to get air put in their tires. You know, and it's just a reminder for the rest of us who don't have these tire pressure monitors that it is winter and it's time to adjust pressures in your tires.
To the point that these lights come on when the air pressure goes down below a certain preset manufacturer or preset limit. Do not panic, owners, if your light comes on. Some vehicles are smart enough now to not just turn on lights but turn on in a complete graphic on your center screen showing four corners of your car and which tire it is that may need, or tires that may need resetting with the cold air going down. Usually, it's always usually in the between 30 and 32 and 36 pounds per square inch. It seems to be the normal range for most tires and most cars to run without these lights coming on. And if it gets cold, as we may have already said, for every 10 degrees it gets colder, the tire pressure goes down in your tire somewhere around 1 pound per square inch. And so if you had set your tire pressures at the right pressure level at 70 and they were now down at 30, they're going to lose 4 pounds of pressure or more, and which is going to set off some of these sensors to turn your lights on. But to Jay's story, the really funny thing is how difficult it is to reset the tire pressure sensors in some of these European cars, I would say. I don't know too much about too many American cars. You should not have to even go into a menu to find out how to do it. Audis have been notoriously difficult in some cases over the years. I didn't know the BMW situation was such a farce. But you go conversely to the Jeeps, and they have a demographic that shows the four corners of the car, the tire pressure in each car, and you go to an air pressure place and start filling it up. You can preset the pressure level you want on these more modern air inflators at garages, and they will ding or send off some alarm when they've reached the tire pressures that you've set to put into your tire. And then the car will reset itself automatically without having you to go into a menu to do a ridiculously simple task.
Having said that, by the way, this reminds me that I just read something in the last couple of days. BMW is taking out some of the functions of those touch screens that they have in all the cars. And that is due to the ongoing chip shortage. And one of the things they've, to save a chip, I guess, here and there, they are taking away the touchscreen functions, yeah, and replacing them in many of their models, even high-end models, with the infamous iDrive, a turn wheel
controller.
And click, which actually I think I prefer. We all know that I'm not a big fan of touchscreens. But I thought that was interesting.
Well, this,
so,
you know,
going back to basics because of chip shortage.
You go to the engineers who try to engineer fancy things into the cars, and you find that some of the basic things are still much more desired by many of us, doesn't matter what age, than these fancy ways of doing things to find, to do things with the stuff you have in your vehicles. Well, we've talked almost endlessly about radios that don't have knobs to turn the stations, because you've got touch buttons on the screen, and the radios now pick the strongest stations, so you jump over the stations you know you can get up here in our northwest corner, which is far away from most broadcast stations. And you can't get to some of these stations that we can get here. And I mentioned that in my test of the V60 Volvo wagon in last week's show, for example. And it goes. And yes, they've been adjusting what technology they will put in cars while they can't get the chips with the newest technology. General Motors had that trouble with some of their pickup trucks. Jay, your point is well taken.
I have a quick question, and then you have to decide whether or not you're going to do safety tips. But the chips, no joke, they're not being fabricated. So what is
They are being fabricated.
Well, okay. What's that going to do to the 22s? Any idea?
Yeah, slow production.
And
let's go to production, because many of the manufacturers are now trying to have everybody who wants to buy one of their cars come in and pre-order it, and they're going to build cars in many manufacturers to those that have been ordered by customers, as opposed to just producing hundreds of vehicles a week, running down an assembly line, putting them in a parking lot, and waiting for dealers to order bulk rate cars to put on their lots. And this is because of the chip shortage that this has been going on. And Ford has an idea that maybe that's the way they're going to try to do sales going forward. And a couple of manufacturers are doing the same. Other manufacturers are doing the same thing. Whether it sticks or not will remain to be seen. But I remember when I bought my first car, which was a Ford Bronco, as some listeners, longtime listeners, know that's what it was, I went and ordered that car. The dealer didn't have anything on the lot, and I ordered it, and I went down the checklist and checked off all the things I wanted and sat back and waited. I think it was something like 6 to 8 weeks, and it came in under a cover so you couldn't see it. And as it was being delivered right around Christmas time, it ended up on the dealer's floor with a big red ribbon on it for me to go and pick it up when I went to see it. But that's how it used to be, and it was always exciting. I loved going and ordering a car and being able to spec what I wanted to put on it.
You still love going into dealerships.
I sure do, and I'm on record in this show.
So let me just in here. I think to answer Jill's question, I'm not sure what's going to happen in 2022. I mean, car sales are going to pick up. They have picked up. The market is hot. But I've seen videos and pictures and read articles. Ford and GM both have huge lots of thousands and thousands of trucks, just to name the trucks, which are a hot commodity, just waiting on lots to have chips installed before they can be shipped. So, you know, I'm guessing all those trucks are going to have to be delivered before they start producing more. So to answer your question, who knows what's going to happen in 2022?
Fair enough. 4 minutes. Do you want to do any safety anything or?
Well,
let me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Why don't you do some safety things, Jill? You're always ranting about something that you run into on the road, and I'd like to hear the latest.
The latest are e-bikes and people who don't know how to ride them.
Oh. Well, that's interesting to bring e-bikes into it or bikes into the show. I think, Jay, you went and tested. I rode an e-bike a couple of years ago, and I think, Jay, recently.
So, Jill, what do you mean by they don't know how to ride them?
She had no balance, and she it was a toss-up whether she was going to fall to the right into the rail or to the left into my car as another car was coming up the road.
So there are different types of e-bikes, and the e-bike you're talking about, I forget the brand. There's a brand out there with the where you squeeze a throttle like on a motorcycle, but it's almost like as soon as you put your foot on the pedal, the thing just takes off. I've ridden one of those. It takes some time to get used to how the thing works. Yes, it's a novelty for many to just, hey, you have an e-bike, let me try it. And all of a sudden, you're going zigzagging and ending in a ditch.
All right, I will say this about her, though. I mean, it was more Miss Gulch. You know, they were just plodding down very specifically Lime Rock Station Road in a line. But so it didn't look like speed was a factor, but I just was really – it looks more like this is someone who – I don't know how she lost I don't know how she lost her balance.
Let me jump in here because I want to keep this shorter. Were they going very slowly?
Not very.
Well,
but it doesn't matter
whether you're an e-bike or a regular pedal bike. When you're going slowly, you don't have the balance and the stability that you do when going faster. But it just goes to show the safety tip is if you're going to come upon bicyclists on the road, be very careful. Don't look at anything but the road and right around where the bicyclists are and get by them safely. And because they go the same direction most of the time that the traffic's going, they can't see then, and they may probably don't have little rear view mirrors on their head straps like the racers do or the professional bicyclists do. They can't see us coming, and if cars are coming the other way, we don't have the ability to go out
and
around them.
Like motorcycles.
Right. No, that's a point. And the other thing, just to add, because this happened returning, maybe it was just the is if you are going to be out walking or biking, especially in this light, you need to take steps not to wear dark clothing. It just shows.
I wish everybody who walks and bikes could listen to us on this show. Because nobody's listening to us walking and biking, as far as I can see, because too few people wear bright clothing, whether walking or bicycling. And as it gets to dusk now, we have daylight savings back in effect. It's darker sooner than ever in the afternoon, and you can't see these people under the trees and in corners. And with glaring headlights coming at you from other directions, from the cars coming, you have a lot to pay attention to.
But there's also something called situational awareness, and I do wish that just in general, bikers or even people, you know, depending on the angle of the light. I had this at the beginning of last week, some construction people, you know,
Jill,
who were directing traffic.
Situational awareness is, you know, I can go on all day about
that.
Yeah,
we can go on all day about that, Jill.
Well, then
key when you are on the road. Whether you're driving, whether you're walking, crossing a street, situational awareness are key words.
And there is your safety tip. He is Robin Leach. He is Jay DeMarkin. This is Car Keys.